alayhi salam. They do not believe in God, the God Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam worshipped. Yet, before Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam, they are humble and respectful. This is the outgrowth of Imam al-Hussein's purity.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope.
Of Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Pereza, London.
Rashan Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Amin Olemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Round the world with reporters.
The 15th Iran-South Africa Joint Commission in Pretoria has wrapped up with 26 cooperation agreements drafted and waiting to be finalized when Iran's president travels to South Africa later in autumn. Another sign of growing ties between the two countries that already enjoy close relations and have always supported each other during hard times.
One of the duties of Iran-South Africa Joint Commission is to come up with solutions to help establish peace and prosperity for nations in Africa and Asia. Moreover, we have high hopes for the outcome and achievements of this commission meeting in enhancing bilateral relations.
The Joint Economic Commission has proven to be more than just that, with shared views on international developments, which confirm Iran's foreign minister's comments when he said great steps have been taken to consolidate relations in various areas. But considering the geopolitical position of the Islamic Republic of Iran and the Republic of South Africa, with Iran eyeing a BRICS membership, it seems that the commonalities might lead to stronger relations than what has been defined by the Joint Commission. Ties that may transcend the realms of bilateral cooperation in a world where more and more countries have expressed their frustration with Western hegemony and U.S. unilateralism.
Dear Minister, you know we are important members of what is termed the Global South. Both our countries are members of the Non-Aligned Movement. Our two nations support multilateralism and thus appreciate the role of the United Nations as the premier multilateral institution, while also advocating strongly for the reform of the United Nations, particularly the role and composition of the United Nations as Security Council.
With the Iranian president expected to pay two separate visits to South Africa, one to attend the BRICS Plus summit on August 24th and another to finalize the 26 cooperation agreements that were drafted by the 15th Joint Commission, prospects of a significant alliance are now stronger than ever. South Africa is considered an important country of the African continent, and the Islamic Republic of Iran has enjoyed warm relations with this country for decades. Now the Raisi administration wants these relations to go to the next level, achieving their full potential, all in line with a new multipolar world order that is emerging. Kisumi Shahmadi, Pretoria.
The Sana'a government is accusing the Saudi-led coalition of exacerbating the humanitarian crisis in Yemen through what it called the illegal blockade on Sana'a International Airport. Before the war was launched against Yemen, over 6,500 passengers were able to fly in and out of Sana'a International Airport per day. However, that number has drastically been reduced to only 900 passengers per week due to the blockade imposed on the country. Because of these restrictions, many sick Yemenis have died since they were not able to fly out of the country in time to seek proper medical treatment. And that's mainly because the Saudi coalition only allows 3 flights into Sana'a Airport per week, a move which violates last year's ceasefire agreement, which stipulated airport restrictions would be lifted. According to the director of Sana'a Airport, Khaled Ashaif, these days Sana'a Airport is mainly used by UN flights for diplomatic purposes only.
After the ceasefire agreement was signed, Sana'a International Airport was supposed to resume flights from Jordan and Egypt. Unfortunately, the Saudi coalition did not meet its end of the deal. They only allowed flights from Jordan, and these flights were limited to 3 per week instead of the agreed 6 flights. I would like the world to know that Sana'a International Airport remains closed. As you can see, the only flights available are those belonging to the United Nations.
Because of limited flights into Sana'a, over 2,500 Yemenis remain stranded in Amman, Jordan.
We are living here in the streets of Amman, as you can see. There are many here who are also stranded and paying ridiculous prices for plane tickets. The prices for Yemen tickets are the most expensive in the world.
Ahmed Ashaf, a Yemeni-British citizen, received news that his mother was ill in Yemen. He was forced to book a flight and try to fly back home as soon as possible. But instead, he was stranded in Amman, Jordan, for 3 weeks.
After I got news that my mother was sick and was taken to intensive care, I needed to fly back to Sana'a immediately. Instead, I was stranded for 3 weeks, unable to visit her. This is a sad and tragic reality. When I finally arrived at Sana'a Airport, I spoke with many of other Yemenis who also suffered in Amman Airport and other airports around the world because they cannot fly back home due to their restrictions.
The Sana'a government continues to urge the Saudi-led coalition to abide by the ceasefire agreement and open Sana'a Airport. Otherwise, all options are on the table. Yusuf Mari, Sana'a.
As the world marks the International Day of the World's Indigenous Peoples, over 5 million Palestinian refugees are still displaced and are scattered all over the world. In 1948, Israeli forces uprooted hundreds of thousands of indigenous Palestinians from their ancestral lands and replaced them by Jewish settlers. Some 1.3 million Palestinian refugees live in the Gaza Strip and reside in 8 refugee camps under miserable living conditions. The majority of Palestinian refugees in Gaza are grappling with poverty and rely on aid from local and international agencies to survive. Unemployment and poverty rates are very high among Palestinian refugees in the tiny seaside territory.
One day we will return to our towns and villages. We have been living in harsh conditions for 75 years amid the silence of the international community. Poverty, unemployment, and sickness are widespread among the refugees. Just look around you. Our living condition is miserable. Israel is responsible for our suffering.
Press TV visited the house of Shwekar Dola, an 85-year-old refugee from the Palestinian city of Jaffa, currently known as Tel Aviv. Shwekar, who lives in the Shati refugee camp, says she has not lost hope of returning to Jaffa.
In 1948, Israeli forces attacked our city and started killing people, including women and children, and I lost many members of my family. My family escaped to Gaza, and I was only 10 years old. We have been living in the refugee camp for 75 years, but I still have the dream of returning to my city, or at least being buried there. Even if I don't return, my children and grandchildren will return.
In 1948, 85% of the Palestinian population faced displacement and disposition, and over 500 villages were destroyed, a somber chapter in the establishment of the Israeli regime. Officials have been repeatedly calling on the international community to help the Palestinian refugees.
The Israeli occupation has made life unbearable for Palestinians since 1948. On this day, indigenous Palestinians continue to live under dire humanitarian conditions after decades of losing their towns and villages, and Palestinian refugees are still scattered in refugee camps. Palestinian refugees were forced at gunpoint to leave their homes in 1948. Sincere international action is needed to help Palestinian refugees.
Palestinians continue to suffer under Israel's occupation and constant human rights violations since 1948.
After more than seven decades of displacement, Palestinian refugees say they hold sacred the right to return to their original lands. Ashraf Shanan, Gaza.
Wednesday was Pakistan's coalition government's last day of power, as Prime Minister Shehbaz Sharif wrote to President Arif Alvi and called for the dissolution of the National Assembly, the lower house of the parliament. Addressing the farewell session of the parliament, Sharif, who was chosen as a prime minister in April last year after his predecessor Imran Khan was ousted in a no-confidence vote, thanked all legislators for their faith in him. The outgoing premier also criticized the policies of Imran Khan's government and blamed it for the current worsening economic situation of the country.
We had to bear the burden of the past regime's negligence and failures during our 16-month rule. The previous government had damaged Pakistan's reputation by violating the agreement signed with the International Monetary Fund.
The expected move to prematurely dissolve the parliament follows Pakistan's top electoral body's decision to bar the former Prime Minister Imran Khan from holding public office for 5 years. The electoral authorities' Tuesday's decision came as Khan was sentenced to 3 years in prison for corruption on Saturday, calling Khan's disqualification from office a punishment for his actions. Some parliamentarians said that the former PM is reaping what he has sowed during his tenure as a PM.
Whatever is happening at the moment with Imran Khan is due to his hostile policies towards his political opponents. His ego and pride not only put him behind bars, but also pushed Pakistan into the dark clouds of uncertainty and political unrest.
Some lawmakers think that all political parties, including Imran Khan's Pakistan Tehreek-e-Insaf party, should be allowed to take part in the upcoming general election.
The current circumstances in the country will lead to the mistrust of the public. Whatever is happening with the PTI party at the moment is not right. Every political body should be provided free space to conduct its election campaign.
Under Pakistan's constitution, if the National Assembly completes its term, elections should be held in 60 days. But in case of its premature dissolution, this period is extended to 90 days. A caretaker government that will oversee the election is likely to be set up in the next 24 hours.
Pakistan is all set to hold fresh elections in the coming days. Experts believe there will be a question mark on the credibility of upcoming polls in the absence of the country's two most popular leaders, Imran Khan and his arch rival, Nawaz Sharif. Nasir Kazmi, Islamabad.
The Lebanese National Army has organized a tour for the diplomatic representatives and members of the United Nations Security Council to show them the places of disputes between Lebanon and Israel and Tel Aviv's violations all along Lebanon's southern borders. The first stop was in the Naqoura area B1, where the first Israeli violation in the sea was spotted at the venue in 1967. The coordinator of the Lebanese government at the United Nations Interim Force in Lebanon, Brigadier General Munir Shahadi, told reporters that the army has recorded thousands of Israeli violations in the sea, land, and air, in addition to permanent violations. Meanwhile, Lebanese army spokesman provided foreign delegations a briefing on the disputed area.
But before the brief, please have a look on the illustrative sketch of the current situation at Naqoura Bayhead. Here have the tunnel entrance on Lebanese side, The blue line is withdrawal line, blue line. And the green line is the international borders green line. And the red line is permanent violation of Israel enemy forces, technical fans on Lebanese territories. And the red triangle here is the violation area.
After a briefing from the Lebanese army, some of the diplomatic representatives gave their observations.
We heard from our friends in the Lebanese army about their argument concerning more than one area on the border. We believe it is very important to find a solution to these disputes. We in Russia always support the Lebanese government, and we support any diplomatic and peaceful efforts to resolve these violations.
When asked about the obvious Israeli violations, the UK's military attaché did not have a clear answer.
There's clearly progress that needs to be made in terms of agreeing where the demarcation lines are, both in terms of the land and on the sea. So we know that there is more work that needs to be done between the two countries to make that clearer.
The tour comes days before the United Nations Security Council renews the annual mandate of the United Nations Interim Force in Lebanon, which was originally established to confirm the withdrawal of Israeli forces after its first invasion in 1978. The Lebanese army has refused any attempted mediation by the U.S. to work on a new land demarcation, stressing that they do not recognize the blue line as an official border line, since Lebanon's official border with occupied Palestine are internationally recognized. The Lebanese army has confirmed through its tour today that the blue line drawn in 2000 is a withdrawal line and not an official border. The Israelis have not only violated the international border demarcated in 1923 between Lebanon and Palestine, but have violated the blue line on a daily basis since the end of the 2006 war. Mariam Saleh, Naqoura, South Lebanon.
Rain or shine, they've been here for more than 3 months. Palestine supporters from the local community and from afar camped out outside a weapons factory owned by Israel's largest arms company, Elbit Systems, in Leicester, England. Their aim, to shut it down for good. Beyond the steel fence and barbed wire, Elbit's drones factory that activists say accounts for the majority of the Israeli regime's UAV fleet, which the company denies. Outside, reminders of how Israel uses them.
Israeli arms factories that are in Britain, and this particular one makes drones and other types of munitions and components. Elbit collectively make just about every single piece of weaponry that you can think of. It's really imperative we shut this particular factory down. It has 6 armed export licenses worth £5 million a year that go to Israel that are then used to terrorize and bomb the Palestinian people.
It all started 100 days ago when Palestine Action members laid siege to the site. But they were arrested and removed by police in May for, quote, conspiracy to do criminal damage.
Palestine Action have laid siege to the company across the country for the past 2 years, leading to the permanent closure of 2 sites and costing the company more than $400 million in lost contracts with the British Ministry of Defense. The void, after they were forcibly removed from here, has been filled in by other pro-Palestinian activists, among them Leicester locals, who say this site here is next.
The 2 closed sites included Elbit's London headquarters and a factory in Greater Manchester, the result of Palestine Action's sustained campaign of direct action in the past 2 years. But it hasn't been easy for them.
Back in May, we were arrested. Most of the Palestine Action people were arrested, and we were given bail conditions. They took our phones and they gave us bail conditions not to be by the site. So what it's meant is that all the people who were really committed routinely were not able to support holding the site.
Yet none of that has fazed these activists, who say every moment an Elbit site is forced to close is a triumph for the Palestinian cause. Saeed Pourreza, London.
Western countries turn their backs on the people of Afghanistan as the NGOs and charities are facing a severe funding gap. Jan Egeland, the head of NRC, in a recent statement has said the NATO countries are turning a blind eye to the plight of the starving Afghan children they left behind, only because the country is not strategically as important as it once used to be. According to some Afghan analysts, Western nations bear responsibility for the challenges endured by the Afghan population and should take corrective measures to address their mistakes.
The plights which Afghan people are facing today are caused mostly by NATO countries, especially the U.S., which invaded our country for 20 years. Today's devastation and crisis in our country are all the results of the U.S. ill policies and decisions. First, they fought a war here, then handed the country to the Taliban, and now they are putting our people under pressure with economic restrictions.
The UN says more than 28 million people in Afghanistan are in dire need of humanitarian aid, especially women and children. Many of them are on the brink of famine and malnutrition. Afghan people say they are awaiting foreign aid for their survival, as they have lost their incomes.
We are not receiving foreign aid anymore. I'm an ordinary worker. I come here every morning to get a job, but no one hires us and we go back home with nothing in our hands. I have a large family and we live in a rented house. I call on the global community not to forget our plights and help us with anything they can. This is the situation of everyone here.
Our sole complaint is that the Western countries created this situation and left us behind. They fueled the war, instability and poverty here and escaped at once. They claim to be sending relief aid, but their small donations are not enough, nor are they reaching qualified people.
This comes as the UK government has been criticized for slashing its aid to Afghanistan by more than half. The US has also frozen Afghan central bank assets and maintained sanctions, paralyzing the economy and other vital infrastructure. After 2 decades of the NATO invasion of Afghanistan, people here are struggling to meet their basic needs. They are calling for more humanitarian aid from wealthy countries and international organizations to mitigate the crisis in Afghanistan. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
Option for today and a better tomorrow. IRIB English Radio. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en.
Experts predicted a looming hunger cliff in the United States back in March, and they were right. According to new data, food insecurity in the United States reaches its highest number since December 2020. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. Truthout noted, back in March, as expanded pandemic-era supplemental nutrition assistance program benefits expired, food insecurity experts were concerned that the United States was racing towards a looming hunger cliff. Now it seems that their predictions were correct, according to new data from the Census Bureau. As the Alliance to End Hunger wrote in a June 30 email, 26.5 million Americans reported food insecurity as of June 19th, according to the Census Bureau's Household Pulse Survey, the most thus far in 2023 and the highest number since December 2020. During the pandemic, SNAP benefits were essentially supercharged as Americans faced furloughs, unemployment, and widespread supply chain disruptions, which had already thrown the grocery buying experience into disarray, in a surge that was categorized as an unprecedented expansion by the New York Times. Jason D. Parrell, more than 6 million people enrolled for food stamps during the first 3 months of the pandemic. While SNAP benefits typically vary based on a recipient's income, during the temporary congressional expansion, recipients were offered the maximum aid available for their household size. However, those benefits were cut months early as part of a bipartisan compromise surrounding a program to provide grocery benefits to replace school meals for low-income children. At the time, the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities, a nonpartisan research and policy institute, reported that the average SNAP recipient would receive at least $90 less per month. The Center reported some households who, under regular SNAP rules, receive low benefits because they have somewhat higher but still modest incomes will see reductions of $250 a month or more. The average person will receive about $90 a month less in SNAP benefits. In a March statement to Sloan Food, Eric Mitchell, the executive director of the Alliance to End Hunger, wrote that there is never a good time to make it harder for people to buy food. But ending benefits now comes at a particularly bad time. Mitchell said, with inflation and food prices still near record levels, it is still far too expensive for many Americans across the country to put food on the table. Without these extra dollars, millions of people will be at risk of hunger. He continued, writing that the expanded benefits were a lifesaver for many individuals and families as jobs disappeared and the economy grinded to a halt. In the ensuing months, the SNAP program has undergone some permanent changes, the most notable being that the age bracket for people who must meet work requirements in order to participate in the program was expanded. As Sloan Food reported in June, this was one of the several concessions made by Democrats as part of a deal to raise the debt ceiling, which the country needed to do later this year to avoid a default crisis. Prior to the pandemic, people younger than 50 who met certain requirements had to volunteer, work, or receive job training for 80 hours a month in order to receive regular assistance. Now, as part of the new budget cuts package, recipients are required to work until the age of 55. According to the Center for Public Integrity, the new stipulations also make it harder for states to waive those work rules in states. Yet after weeks of debate, the new budget cuts package now raises the age of recipients required to work to 55. And according to the Center for Public Integrity, makes it harder for states to waive work rules in areas with high unemployment. Notable exceptions include if someone is experiencing homelessness, is a military veteran, or if they are a youth aged 18 to 24 who has aged out of the foster care system. Currently, there are also two bills under review that would prevent current SNAP recipients from buying junk food classified as candy, ice cream, and prepared desserts, such as cakes, pies, cookies, or similar products, with their benefits. Several hunger experts have raised concern at both developments, especially in light of the newest food insecurity numbers. According to the Center on Budget Policies and Priorities, the expansion of working age would take food assistance away from large numbers of people, including many who have serious barriers to employment, as well as others who are working or should be exempt but are caught up in red tape. Meanwhile, a spokesperson from the Agriculture Department told Spectrum News that further monitoring of what SNAP recipients purchase with their benefits would increase program cost and complexity and undermine the dignity of millions of Americans by assuming that low-income Americans are unable to make decisions that are best for themselves and their families. According to NBC News, with food prices up 6.7% compared to this time last year, the United States service members and their families experience food insecurity at higher rates than the general public. Also, Guardian had reported, food insecurity remains stubbornly high in the United States. According to Guardian, 1 in 10 American households struggled to feed their families last year, with more than 5 million families missing meals and cutting portions due to poverty, new government research has revealed.
Joining us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Hello and welcome to Spotlight. The Iranian Foreign Ministry says the process to unblock the nation's several billion-dollar assets illegally frozen by the U.S. has kicked off. Iran's Deputy Foreign Minister Ali Baghdadi-Khani says that Tehran has received guarantees for Washington's commitment to its obligations. According to the Iranian official, the release of several Iranians who were illegally detained in the United States under the pretext of bypassing U.S. sanctions also comes in this context. Several Iranian-Americans convicted in Iran on spying charges are also expected to be released once the U.S. implements its commitments. The Iranian officials have already announced that Tehran is open to prisoner exchange talks with the U.S. out of respect for humanitarian issues. Joining us on Spotlight, we have Professor at University of Tehran and political analyst Mr. Fouad Izadi, who's joining us from the Iranian capital, Tehran. And anti-war activist and member of the Answer Coalition, Richard Becker, is joining us from San Francisco.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Gentlemen, welcome to the program. Let's start off with Professor Izadi in Tehran. Iran's assets that were frozen in South Korea due to U.S. sanctions are to be released. What is your analysis on this development?
Well, as you correctly stated, the sanctions are illegal. We have the U.S. Congress blocking money that belongs to the Iranian people. It's a violation of the nuclear agreement. As you know, the nuclear agreement was codified in UN Resolution 2231. United States left the agreement during the Trump administration, and Biden refuses to return to the agreement and implements all the sanctions that are out there passed by the U.S. Congress against Iran. That's why they're illegal. Not following UN resolutions is illegal. U.S. is a member of the permanent five, the P5 countries that are in the Security Council, permanent members of the Security Council. The U.S. is not only not following the UN resolution, they are punishing countries that want to follow UN resolution, including South Korea. They are violating other countries' sovereignty. That's a very basic right that countries have to decide to do what is best for them. So the U.S. is telling South Korean companies that they need to follow U.S. Congress's sanctions and rules and regulations. And that's violating South Korea's sovereignty. That's violating other countries' sovereignty that want to have economic trade with Iran. So returning these funds to Iran under severe restrictions is not a big achievement for the United States. So what the U.S. is doing is that they engage in espionage against Iran all the time. They blow up places in Iran with the help of Israelis sometimes, sometimes on their own. And when these people are caught, they get them back through blockading Iranian money. That's how they operate when it comes to their operations in Iran. And obviously, the Raisi administration is interested in this money, and they go along with this setup. But this doesn't make what the U.S. is doing correct.
Richard Becker, the U.S. has imposed rounds of unilateral sanctions against Iran over its nuclear energy program. In your opinion, can this new development be seen as yet another indication that the U.S. maximum pressure has not been successful against Iran?
I think that the sanctions against Iran, like the sanctions against Cuba, Venezuela, North Korea, and numerous other countries, are causing great suffering among the populations. This is particularly true for smaller countries, which have the very limited ability to meet all the needs, to produce everything that's needed, and the vast variety of goods and commodities that are needed in modern society. They're causing great suffering. They're not succeeding, as your other guest indicated. I think that the what we see happening right now in regard to Iran is after Trump had withdrew from the JCPOA, illegally withdrew from it, Biden continues their policy, so and imposing more and more sanctions. So it is causing suffering among the people, but it's not succeeding and it's not going to succeed. And you can see, you know, I would cite one difference is that, you know, an important difference is that 70 years ago this year, I believe it was 70 years ago this year, the sanctions, the blockade that was imposed, the embargo of Iranian oil on the world market imposed by the British and the United States did lead to played a critical role in the overthrow of the Mossadegh government at that time. That's not happening here. That clearly is not happening in regard to Iran. The sanctions are not bringing down the government or causing, they're causing harm, but they're not causing the kind of harm that's going to bring about the regime change that Washington is seeking.
Professor Izadi, despite Iran's commitment to the 2015 nuclear deal, as mentioned by UN, our guest in San Francisco, the U.S. unilaterally withdrew from the JCPOA, then reimposed basically sanctions on Tehran. That's why Tehran says Washington is not trustworthy. Iran, in this case, says it has received guarantees from Washington's commitment to its obligations this time. Unpack that issue for us, the trustworthy of the United States when it comes to signing deals.
You know, Richard Becker a minute ago talked about Mohammad Mossadegh's government and the 1953 coup d'etat in Iran. This year makes the 70th anniversary of that coup d'etat. And the Iranian people have learned the fact that the United States is a hostile power. Not only Iranians inside Iran. We have five Iranians that are jailed in the United States for, you know, they're accused of violating the sanctions that are illegal. And they are generally victims of FBI fishing expeditions, putting people in situations where they can be placed under arrest and put in jail, generally for political reasons more than anything else. So these type of hostilities have been with us from the United States for many decades. And as was correctly said, Iran is not allowed. We have many countries, Cuba, Nicaragua, Venezuela, in Latin America, other countries in Africa, in Asia, in other continents that are victims of U.S. Imperialism and aggression. The good news is that it's this type of policies generally backfire. And the reason we don't have an American embassy in Tehran today is because out of the U.S. embassy, we had the 1953 coup, and the Iranian people are not going to allow that to happen again. So overall, I think all the attempts to put pressure on the Iranian people with the hope of people putting pressure on the government and you know, engaging in some sort of color revolution. The U.S. policies have resulted in Iran not only surviving, but becoming stronger in comparison to what we had before. And that's the result of the misguided and short-sighted policies that we see from Washington.
Richard Becker, there were years of accusations that Iran was seeking to build a nuclear weapon. Then the JCPOA deal, which resulted in inspections and et cetera, that came along. Then the U.S. pulled out of the deal. Why should the U.S. Be trusted? Iran is right to ask for assurances when the U.S. has shown that it can't be trusted, even when it does sign deals.
Yeah, and, you know, I don't like to say it, and I don't say it because I'm a supporter of Biden, but, you know, there's a very good possibility that Trump will return to the presidency. So I think that, you know, that underlines the importance of there being some kind of assurance, binding insurance given to Iran in regard to a return to the JCPOA if that were to happen. And I'm not saying that it's going to, but there certainly is a great cause given, you know, the U.S. put the Shah on the throne, and I don't think this is, like, forgotten. I mean, millions of Iranians are alive today who, you know, people of my age and even younger who can remember that what the Shah's regime was like. and how it served the interests of the U.S. and the royal family in a very thin layer at the top, but imposed great suffering on the Iranian people, and that was coming from the U.S. embassy. That was coming from Washington. The support for the Shah and the hailing of the Shah, even by liberals like Jimmy Carter. So, yes, given that history and given the more recent history of the abandonment, the walking away from JCPOA, there certainly is a great cause for the Iranian side to demand a binding agreement, not to overturn a new agreement were there to be one.
Professor Izadi, despite claims made by the U.S. Treasury in the past that the sanctions on Iran don't apply to transactions for the provision of agricultural commodities, food, medicine, or medical devices to Iran, even Europeans in this case have asserted that the U.S. sanctions have dire humanitarian consequences. The U.S. has a tendency to target ordinary citizens with its sanctions, doesn't it?
And they do, not only Iranians that are in jail in the United States, but nationals of many other countries that are put under sanctions because of trading with Iran or working with Iran on economic issues. The United States basically bullies other countries, companies that belong to other countries. And prevents them from working with Iran. They say that food and medicine is exempt from sanctions, but in practice, because of banking sanctions and banking restrictions, Iran is not able to engage in these type of activities even when Iran has the money, because the money cannot be transferred to the companies because of the sanctions, banking sanctions from the United States. And even in this current deal that we are talking about, they say it's going to take about a month for it to go through because of all the complications that the United States has when it comes to money transfer that belongs to Iran. So even when U.S. government officials decide to engage in some sort of agreement with Iran, they cannot do it given the fact that this web of sanctions around Iran that they created is causing so much difficulties. So we don't have to go back to 1953 to see what the U.S. is doing to the Iranian people. We have people that don't have access to the medicine that they want. Iran makes more than 90% of the medicine that the country needs internally, but for certain type of medicines, Iran has to import, and there are difficulties in this type of trade because of U.S. sanctions. So people are suffering, and some people are dying because of what the Biden administration has decided to do, to continue the failed policies of the Trump administration.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Richard Becker, Iranian President Ebrahim Raisi has insisted many times that the country will not abandon the negotiating table, but will also refuse to bow down to excessive demands that violate its national interests. The president believes that the U.S. sanctions against Iran are unjust, and Washington needs to remove them. Given all we've discussed tonight, where do you believe the U.S. stands on any future negotiations, most notably the issue of sanctions removal?
Well, first of all, let me say that, as your other guest stated, the idea of that food and medicine are being excluded from this is a false idea, a completely false idea, that somehow there's a humanitarian avenue for countries that are under sanction. No, it's not true. For one thing, the point about Iran produces a great deal of medicine and a great variety of medicine, but there are certain medicines that are only produced in the United States or by U.S. companies that are, in many cases, life-saving medicine, like medicines for that can treat and cure leukemia among young children. Very hard to get, very expensive, and not available and not produced almost by anywhere by the U.S. or the U.S. and its allies. So, and I know this too. I was in Iraq twice during the sanctions on Iraq, and Iraq was a far less developed country than Iran, of course, and so it wasn't able to produce that kind of medicine. So there, when I went first in 1994, after 3.5 years, there was virtually no medicine in the hospitals. People were not going to the hospitals anymore, only to die. Families would be there with their children who were dying of very treatable diseases. So that's a point of great hypocrisy when they say that this point about food and medicine being excluded. And the extraterritoriality that your other guest mentioned is very important. This is illegal. This is interference in the affairs and the sovereignty of countries all over the world. They are the sanctions are imposed upon them as well, in the sense that if they continue to trade with Iran or with Cuba or with Venezuela or Nicaragua or any of the countries that are sanctioned, their companies, their banks, their governments can suffer enormous economic consequences, financial consequences because of that. So I think these are important points to make. And I think that it is a sense of encouragement that countries are resisting and resisting very strongly against this and trying to find a way past it. But we must keep in mind the suffering that this is imposing on the population of much of the world.
And Professor Izadi, one last question for you. What are the underlying reasons, in your opinion, for the decades of U.S. animosity towards Iran and its anti-Iran policies?
You know, one would assume it's the 1979 revolution and the fact that the new government deposed of a U.S. puppet in Iran. But I don't think that's a complete answer, because the animosity has started well before 1979. It started when the United States decided to cooperate with the UK to organize that coup in Iran. And that's the type of animosity we have been experiencing for the last 70 years. And the fact that Iran is able to survive and progress is another issue that's causing difficulties in Washington, because you're not supposed